see why I should keep you waiting, and maybe there'll be some opportunity to bring them up to date too. I hope all of you who have been here previously picked up a copy of Indian Truth if it interests you. There's some more lying out there, and also this is a bibliography of the books that relate to the different talks in this series, of which I have a number also out on the table. Another book that is not listed because it just came out this month is this book by Robert Burnett, The Road to Wounded Knee, which I would recommend strongly. It's a very informative book. His previous book, I don't think it's listed here, but you'll see a picture of it, had so much libelous material in it that I'm afraid it was withdrawn from circulation, so it may be pretty hard to get a copy of it, although I have one. This is much more informative and maybe written with a little more caution, although he sure takes a lot of swipes at people. He has it in for. He's a very forthright person. But it's a very informative book, and it also costs only about a third what the other book costs, so I recommend it. Well, today we're talking about current issues and new directions about Native Americans. The things that concern the Indians now mostly are their treaty rights, their sovereignty, and their resources in general. And in particular, the specifics would be education, health, economics, housing, law and order, genocide, and airship. I might also add Indian preference for employment. Now I'll speak a little bit about these in more detail. Indians through history have entered into treaties with the United States, and they expect us to live up to them. They say there are 371 and all of them have been broken. And that's what led it up to the occupation of the Bureau of Indian Affairs at election time 1972, and to the Wounded Knee village occupation this past year, and the troubles with fishing rights in the state of Washington, and many other places. And there are also instances where Indians entered into agreements with the negotiators or the army or whoever represented the United States government, and then the Senate did not ratify the treaty. So no treaty eventuated, but the Indians gave up everything that was being bargained for and got nothing in return. So there are many instances, particularly, say, California and some of the Paiutes and a good many others, who thought they were going to get a treaty, but they never did. They just lost everything. And because they had these treaties, and they were dealt with as being nations, and the treaties haven't been, they may have been violated, but they haven't been annulled or renegotiated, many of these people consider themselves still to be sovereign nations. And they so call themselves the Sioux Nation and the Seneca Nation, etc. They think they have the right of self-determination in many respects, which we usually honor in the breach. But there are times when that becomes an issue, such as in conscription. Many Indians have refused to be conscripted. Just very recently, the associate editor of Akwesasne Notes, a copy of which is here and some lying out there on the table, which I hope you're familiar with, was indicted for refusing to serve under selective service or to register. He just doesn't think. And Navajo won his case after quite some litigation, because in the treaty with the Navajo, they have agreed that they will not fight the white people. Well, therefore, they say it's, they are obligated not to serve in our armies. And this particular person won his case by being required to stay on the Navajo reservation for a period, I think, of 5 years. Many others, of course, have gone to jail for refusal to serve in the army. And the resources, particularly land and water and minerals, we're continually ripping them off. If we can make some money on it, then it's pretty hard to keep the white people away, such as the Black Hills in South Dakota. And many other places, you'll see some pictures of Cochiti and similarly Tizuki, and more recently Alaska, where the native people should, by all justice and honor, own the whole place, except for maybe a few acres that the Russians took by some hook or crook, and they may have said they had title to some forts and some trading posts and a few acres, but everything else certainly belonged to the natives. But when we acquired sovereignty by buying it from Russia for a few million dollars, we then said we owned all the real estate. Well, of course, we didn't. We simply acquired sovereignty. But the recent Alaska Native Land Claims Act gives 1/6 of the population, that is the natives, I think 1/20 of all the land. And we think we're being generous to let them have 1/20 of the land when, by all rights, they ought to have the whole thing. And even that is hedged with some requirements that they only have 20 years, I think, to make claim to particular land. It's going to take 40 years or more, by estimate, to even survey it, to designate what piece of land is what piece of land. And yet the whole act will have expired before it can possibly be surveyed so that the individuals can have what's coming to them. Water rights constantly being violated. The whole issue of it's down on the table. Race Relations Reporter, the last issue, just out. A comprehensive article about the way we're stealing water from Indians. And I'll show you some pictures and I'll make some comments with those illustrations. Pyramid Lake, where court cases, the Indians have won, and the Secretary of the Interior continues to violate the court order and continues to take the water away from the lake to give it to the Bureau of Reclamation and to white ranchers. And they go to court again, and the courts tell the Secretary of the Interior to stop disobeying the law and previous court orders. Well, I don't know if they've stopped taking it yet, because there are thousands, literally thousands of building permits in Reno and Lake Tahoe area that hinge on having a permit to get the water. If you can't get water for the human needs, then they're not allowed to build a new building. And they don't have the water unless they can get it from the Indians. And other places, at Cochiti, I'll show you a picture. Real estate developers find it much cheaper to get a large block of land from Indians who have a large block of land rather than go out on the open market and try to get little parcels where the price would go up if they knew somebody's trying to buy up a big tract of land for a development. Well, they don't even have to buy it. They just lease it from the Indians. Very little capital is involved. They get a 99-year lease from the Indians with the connivance of the Bureau of Indian Affairs. And then they improve it which will be soon at the buyer's expense, of course, so there's very little capital from the developers, but they need the water. And it's on the Rio Grande, and there isn't too much water. So they get the Army engineers and the taxpayer to put in some $60 million to build a dam and to make a water lake that will be attractive for the residential area. And then so that won't transpire too much water and the consumption of water will not diminish the Rio Grande, they nick the taxpayer for another $60 million to build a tunnel underneath the Rocky Mountains to bring western water east to put it into the river so that we won't violate our treaty with Mexico by diminishing the water supply. So at the taxpayer's expense and at the Indians' expense and at the future buyer's expense, these developers are going to make hundreds of millions of dollars on a development that is a very questionable benefit to anybody but them. And the resources of the Four Corners, the strip mining on the Black Mesa and Hopi land and at the Four Corners Navajo country. Not only are they disrupting the surface and the use of the land for grazing by the strip mining, but also the pollution from the power plants and also the great use of water, subterranean water, which is necessary not only for the power plant, but one of the power plants grinds up the coal and makes a slurry out of it using huge amounts of water, and they pipe the slurry down to the farthest corner of Nevada where they have another power plant, which is as close to Los Angeles as they can legally get. They're not allowed to have a power plant that's as dirty as that in California, but in Nevada they can do it and get away with it. I'm glad to report, however, that they are now monitoring the atmosphere, not as a enforcement, but just as a check to see if the new devices that are to be put in will do any good. They're measuring how bad it is now and see if it's any better when they made some improvements. Well, education, as I mentioned, it's been our education from the start, the mission education, and then the Bureau of Indian Affairs education, and now mostly public education. The public education, well, all these educations are, with a very few exceptions, are done by a school system entirely under the supervision management of white people, middle-class white values. The public education is a federal expense, as are the others, except for the mission. Even some mission stations get some federal support. It's not Indian education, except for very few exceptions. It'd be just about as appropriate as if I had to get my education by going to a Catholic seminary or something of the sort, which wouldn't be giving the education that I would be seeking. And so most of the Indian students drop out. It just isn't appropriate for them. However, the picture is changing some. There are improvements, and I understand there's something like 10 times as many Indians in college now as was the case 10 years ago. If it isn't that, it's more than that. It's increasing very greatly. Health has been a problem, largely because of lack of sanitation and poverty. Diet isn't good, housing isn't good, sanitation isn't good. Remote from health care. A lot is done by the government, but then there's a lot that isn't done by their neighbors, too. It's just very recently that the public hospital at Anadarko, Oklahoma, by court order, had to put up signs in the building and advertisements in the newspaper saying that Indians would not be discriminated against, because, of course, they had been discriminated against. And just very recently, I read in the news of Sioux Country that a baby died because the hospital wouldn't admit it. They say, there are Indian hospitals for you people. Take them to the Indian hospital, even if it's 200 miles away. So there are diseases that Indians have that the rest of us don't have anymore. Their health condition is that of ours. Our population a generation ago. Economics, they're the poorest of any identifiable economic group. Figures are different in all parts of the country, and it's hard to get any kind of averages, but something like $500 a person wouldn't be very far off per year. Now, the federal expenditures are closer to $2,000 an Indian. Of course, there's an overlapping there because all these Indians are getting services out of these $2,000, some educational benefits and health benefits and highway construction and things that would have been at the cost of taxation. But still, Indians often point to that they wouldn't be anywhere near as hard up if the federal appropriations were simply doled out to them per capita. And they would have $2,500 per person income, apparently, not really, but very considerably more than they have now. Because much of this federal money, $1 billion a year nearly, health and education and every other service, and much of that goes to salaries of white people and overhead, and Indians don't think they get the benefit of it. Housing is a problem, as I said, due to the economics of the situation, and in many cases because of the difficulties of the climate, Alaska, Northern Plains, places where building materials are expensive and the winters are severe, housing is a very serious problem, as well as sanitation that goes with it. Law and order problems. Many of the Indian groups are so small that they can't have their own professional police force and court system. Some do, of course. But there's often a conflict with the states who, under public law 280, have the right to take over law and order on reservations, usually not in order to give the Indians any protection and any services, but in order to have control over the Indians. They don't expect to spend white taxpayers' money on good police protection and services for Indians. States are continuously moving in on Indian groups to tax them, in spite of state constitutions that they have nothing to do with Indian affairs. Cigarette taxes, gasoline taxes, sales taxes on the reservation. These are frequently infringed upon. Genocide. You may not think that genocide is going on now by some sort of extermination, but in the Indians' eyes and way of thinking and definition of the term, it is. They consider genocide our education system. That it isn't their education system. It's imposed upon them by law. They have to take our education system, whether it means anything to them or not. And the courts can move in on an Indian family and take the children away from the parents, which they do. In the state of Minnesota, 24 times as many Indian children are in non-Indian homes, adoption homes, as is the case for white children. In other words, the courts consider that Indian parents aren't fit parents. Now, they may be alcoholic, they may be poor, they may have unsatisfactory housing, but poverty isn't the worst crime in the world in the eyes of Indians, and housing may be simple and may be inadequate, but the Indians consider it genocide to have your children stolen from you against your will and by police force simply taken away and put into somebody else's home. The airship problem. With the trust protection of Indian land by the federal government and the Allotment Act of 1887, a great deal of land has been put into individual ownership, not tribal ownership as a characteristic Indian fashion, with the result that when the owner dies, it goes to his heirs, and so many 160 acres or whatever amount the original owner had may be divided up into 100 or so fractions, heirs to that piece of property, so it's quite useless. Only thing you can do with it is to sell it and share the money. Well, that means it goes out of Indian ownership because not very many Indians have the capital to purchase land. So many of these Indian reservations that you see on the map and look pretty large, most of the land has already been alienated, and that which has not been alienated is leased, because you can take a piece of land that has many owners and share the rent, even though the many owners can't use it themselves. Another problem of the present is that is this current revenue sharing policy of the federal government. Nixon's policy was signed here in Philadelphia. That means that some of the federal money income is returned to the states to be spent locally, what they call regionalization. And that means that instead of having an Indian-informed bureau in Washington knowing what to do for the benefit of Indians with federal money, the money is sent off to the different states, and local boards will decide what to do with it. A housing board out in South Dakota will decide what to do with federal money for housing. Well, there won't be any Indians on that board, you can be sure of that. And therefore, the Indians won't be getting any of this federal money for whatever it is the federal government is appropriating money for the benefit of the regions. Indians are one half of 1% of the population, and they just don't get represented. The Indians employed in New Mexico, I think it's 7-8% of the population of New Mexico is Indian. Well, the number of people who have federal jobs in New Mexico is less than 1%. And the same with, and that's federal employment, which is supposed to be equal opportunity. Maybe even better than equal opportunity, because in the Bureau of Indian Affairs, at least, there's Indian preference legislation. Well, the non-Indian employees of the Bureau of Indian Affairs have gone to court to sue because they say that's unconstitutional to give one race a privilege in employment over another race. Even though it may be the Bureau of Indian Affairs that's supposedly helping Indians, they have the employment and promotion practices stymied at the moment because the courts haven't, they're conflicting court rulings at present. It hasn't gotten to the Supreme Court yet to know whether it's legal to give Indians a preference in employment in their own bureau. And there are Indian problems, of course, locally, such as in Oklahoma, Indian boys with long hair. They may be in a dance group or a music group that for which long hair is appropriate and maybe even requisite, and yet the school boards won't let them go to school if they have long hair. And the Supreme Court did rule on that. They said that long hair is not constitutionally protected. so that if the local school boards do want to enforce short hair on boys, then nothing about the Constitution says they can't. So there are boys in Oklahoma who are not allowed to go to school. Now, these troubles are caused by us, of course. They think the Indian problem is the white man. And I tried to put some ideas together as why that's the case. And of course, we have just lots of different culture values and different heritage that we have different practices. And I just wonder if the trouble basically doesn't really go back to our anthropomorphic God. He's male. He's an authority figure. And we are his chosen people. And people are his chosen creatures. And this idea of dominance is approved. I mean, there's approval stamped on the idea of dominance. And God is dominant, and we're his chosen people. We're by delegation. We can be arrogant, too, over nature and over animals, over people who are different from ourselves. It's all right to conquer people. It's all right to have slaves. It's all right to put women down. It's all right to put different kinds of people down if they have different color skin. And it's all right to make people over, to manipulate them, to try to change their ways. Because we're semi-divine. We're in God's own image. I think that's gotten us off on the wrong track. If human beings can be so dominant, then private property becomes a result. And Indians, of course, didn't have anything like private property. But private property leads into all sorts of things. War and selfishness and classes and wealth. Anybody who's wealthy is powerful by divine right. I mean, it's okay to be powerful if you're wealthy. It's approved. And our materialism, our whole attitude toward man's place in the universe, I think goes back to that one root. This thought hadn't come to me until this afternoon. But I think of the difference. We say, "Our Father who art in heaven." And that's been a holy concept to me. That's the ultimate good, you might say. But the Indian doesn't say that. He says, "My mother the earth, my father the sky." Now, they're all very similar. Say, "Our Father who art in heaven," and "Our father the sky, our mother the earth." But I think they're a world, a universe apart. In one case, we have a dominant figure with whom we are specially privileged. And in the other concept, we're all in the same boat. We're just part of nature, we're part of the universe, and we should live harmoniously with it. And I don't know if you agree with me or not, but I think that gets pretty close to the core of the differences between Indians and us, and the reason we're having problems. We have real conflicts here of our whole way of life and our whole value system. Now, what we do from here, this title of this lecture is supposed to be New Directions. What we do about all this, that's a big problem. But as Vine Deloria keeps saying, this isn't 1874, this is 1974, and we have today's problems to solve. And you don't solve them just by reading the history books or knowing about Chief Red Fox or Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee or some of these perfectly valid history. It's well to know about, but that's different than today. And Crazy Horse and Sitting Bull and some of the heroes of the past, they're not Russell Means and Dennis Banks and some of today's troublemakers, militants, or whatever you may call them. And I'm predicting that there's going to be more militancy among Indians in the future. They say that when there's no hope, there's no fear. And Indians just don't have much hope. And so they'll try anything. They've been, you know, of some demonstrations at Alcatraz, and at the takeover of the Bureau of Indian Affairs 2 years ago, nearly, and the Wounded Knee occupation. And since then, there have been a lot more. Custer, South Dakota, Gordon, Nebraska, Rapid City, Denver, Albuquerque, Gallup, Santa Fe. Indians are really standing up on their hind legs and not necessarily being violent, not necessarily being they have been violent at times, but they never intended to be. Not a single instance did they enter into a project with the intention of being violent. They're too smart for that. Half of 1% of the population with no money, or where would they ever get with the police department? No violence has been forced upon them. But at least they're speaking up, which they've always been too meek and humble and too defeated in the past to do. And they've got some organizations going with some expertise, some sophistication, some organization, some money, not much, but National Congress of American Indians, National Tribal Chairman's Association, Native American Rights Fund, which is perhaps doing in a much bigger way what Indian Rights Association was set up to do and did do and would like to do, but we didn't get several million from the Ford Foundation to do it with, and they did. Of course, Ford Foundation only sees you on your way for 3 years or so, and then you're on your own. And so now the Native American Rights Fund is circularizing people whom they can get on their list to try to raise some money so they can continue, and I hope they can. And the National Indian Youth Council, college-age youth for the most part, very bright and active and fearless, intelligent people. And the Indian Legal Information Development Service, a copy lies here, and I think one's out there if you want to see what sort of things they publish. American Indian Press Association, sending out good press releases. They have some very able writers. Richard LaCourse was speaking at the annual meeting of the Indian Rights Association a couple weeks ago, and he says he's traveled 500,000 miles in the last 2 years or so that he's been on the job. It turns out a lot of information. And the United Scholarship Service started here in the East as a non-Indian thing, pro-Indian. Now it's been taken over completely by Indians, finding scholarships and giving counseling to high school and college students. So Indians are beginning to take over the affairs, their own affairs. Now, where does that leave people like us, the Indian Rights Association, the Association of American Indian Affairs, Quaker Peace, Quaker Indian committees, and church groups who have Indian interests? Well, we certainly have to stop our paternalism, and we have to stop trying to manipulate. But we're welcome. They don't want to get rid of us. They just want us to listen more and talk less, decide less, be helpful to them. They need plenty of help. They want friends, but they don't want some of the kinds of friends they've had in the past. But what's the saying? We've got enough enemies as it is. We don't need friends like that. Well, I would hope that in the future we would learn more to respect differences. This theory of the melting pot has been discredited. We ought to value differences, ought to welcome differences. In the vicissitudes of evolution, we don't know what's going to come up next, and whether we have survival or not depends on what the options are. And if everybody's all alike, there aren't any options. And therefore, if we want survival, we need to have various variations available to us, or available. It may well be that our lifestyle is not a viable one. And if we can't change it, then we go under. And somebody who lives by a different lifestyle can make a go of it. Well, Indians never did depend on machinery. And when at Wounded Knee, the federal marshal said, we'll cut off their electricity, we'll prevent them any food from coming in and any medicines from coming in, fuel, Indians laughed at that. They're not used to having any of these special services anyhow. They're not used to having electricity in their houses and running water, and a certain amount of famine is not unknown to them. They can stand these vicissitudes. Part of the traditions, the differences are religious and cultural value differences. I think we have to learn to respect them. And maybe even have a feeling of appreciation for some of the things that Indians have done for us. Many of our predecessors in this country found hospitality. I know in my own ancestors, my Brinton family ancestors, they tell of the Indians who helped them through their first winter, and they wouldn't have made it, so Howard Brinton has told me, if it hadn't been for the Lenape Indians who helped them with food. And incidentally, most of the world's food was not known before Columbus. It was only not known in Europe and elsewhere. It was only American. Particularly corn, which was not something the Indians were just lucky to find over here, but it's something that they developed. They developed it genetically from sort of a grass and made the very fruitful, productive food crop that it is. The idea of tribalism. I wish I remembered the name of a book I just saw in Hereford College Library yesterday, something about communal living. Well, it was a substantial sociological book. Hope to get it out and read it. But forgot the author's name. But this idea of tribalism, communal living, is growing, I believe. Maybe Pendle Hill feels it more than most people in our society feel it. This business of rootless individualism isn't a very rewarding life, and the Indians pity us for being such lonely people, such unhappy people, when they feel so rewarded by being a member of a community of people who believe in living together in harmony. And another thought that Vyndaloric mentions in some of his talks, but also I think in his book God Is Red, that this is the real world. Indians have believed that, as I mentioned here before, our friend William Bacon Evans said. White man always getting ready to live. Indian, he lives all the time. This is really it, and I think those who think that this is just a prelude to the real world of heaven are really deluding themselves. That this is what God gave us to enjoy now. And some of these ideas of harmony with each other and with all of nature and all of creation, I think, is a very beautiful concept. So finally, before I show the slides, I want to say the main message that Indians bring to us is to make our own society an ethical one. If we clean up our own society, they'll do all right. They're not asking us to solve their problems. They tell us we better solve ours. So, I'll turn the projector on.